Last time on Appalachian Mysteria, the man standing over the girl's makeshift grave was investigated and discovered to have an alibi. One of the girl's doormates was called in to help the police sketch a suspect, and Triangle was revealed to be a psychic cult that not only had nothing to do with the murders, but were trying to help solve the case. On this episode, the top remaining suspects in the case as we take our final step closer to a trial and conviction. We should note that while this show inherently deals with murder, the remaining episodes contain some graphic descriptions of violence against women. Listener discretion is advised. Some of the names in this episode have been changed. To understand this episode, it's important for listeners to understand something that's rarely acknowledged in American society, which is this. As this show is being recorded in 2017, we're living in one of the safest times in the history of our nation. A brief survey of mainstream media would have you believe in massive crime waves and gun violence epidemics. A brief conversation with some very nice older folks will have you believing in the good old days when people were civil and violence was nearly unheard of, and you didn't have to watch your kids so closely. All of this is nonsense. Violent crime in the early 70s makes the 21st century look like a playground. We'll come back to this at the end of the episode, but I wanted to plant the seed of this idea now because it's important to understand that the problem for investigators in Merritt and Karen's murders is not that there weren't enough viable suspects. It was that there were way too many suspects. Here's Dan Ringer, defense co-counsel for the man who was eventually convicted.
What we learned from reading the materials from the original search back in 1970 is that there are a lot of very strange, very violent, very nasty people out there running around. And every time we would find one or read about one, we'd think, well, maybe this is the guy that did it. And that's one of the things that kept the police going in 24 different directions.
Obviously, we'll be coming back to Ringer in the final episodes. Another thing to keep in mind is that we jumped ahead in our timeline last episode to wrap up the story of Triangle. Richard Hoover's psychic cult wasn't revealed until July, so most of the investigations we're about to describe took place when police were still fixated on Triangle as a primary suspect. These are things to remember as we move forward and discuss just a few of the many suspects in the murders of Merritt and Karen. Suspect, Elias Castellanos.
When Merritt's purse was found, the contents were included 13 cents, a dime and 3 pennies, and a receipt for services at a dental office. The dental office turned out to be Elias Castellanos, who's a well-known dentist and character around Morgantown. He once ran for Senate in the 80s, lost by a good deal, but it's a good try. He was one of the first dentists to try and bring TMJ, make it more well understood by the public.
The investigation into Castellanos seems to have been instigated to some degree by Merritt's sister, Peggy. In late March, about 2 months after the girls disappeared, Peggy and her husband came to Morgantown to check up on the investigation and talk to police. While in town, they stayed with Merritt's boyfriend. While going over everything amongst themselves, Peggy asked, "So who's this dentist?" Merritt's boyfriend identified him as Elias Castellanos.
So they gave him a call. On March 23rd, he talked to them at some length. And the next day, apparently it inspired Dr. Castellanos to write a letter to the paper.
We don't currently have access to this letter, and it may not exist anymore. But on March 25th, at the end of one of the many articles published by the Dominion News about the co-eds, this paragraph appears. Quote, "Incompleted dental work on Miss Malerick may contribute information leading to solving the girl's disappearance. A Morgantown dentist, who preferred not to be named, has said that he had done dental work on Miss Malerick, but had not completed the treatment at the time of the disappearance. The dentist added that the girl, if she is alive, would need dental treatment.
He had given Merritt a filling on January 10th, and they had planned to do a root canal on January 19th, the day after they disappeared. So she would be in significant pain, is what he was saying. He sounded concerned, and he was fretting about the fact that she would be in significant pain if she hadn't seen another dentist. The police, of course, talked to him after that came in. They talked to him for a while and dismissed him as a suspect or of interest, even though they had a report that someone had come forward, a woman, and claimed to have been molested in a dental chair with Dr. Castellanos in 1960. At the time, he was never charged or convicted of anything, but her life fell apart.
Added to this, investigators eventually discovered that Castellanos had called Westchester, Merritt and Karen's dorm, on January 19th, the night after the girls disappeared. This was seen as possible alibying behavior, a way to demonstrate ignorance of the crime by pretending to believe that Merritt would be available. And that wasn't all.
There were rumors about him all around town. Rumors that he had been picking up hitchhikers in his white Cadillac, and he liked to pick up female hitchhikers. There are also rumors that other patients had alleged that he had sexually harassed them in a dental chair, you know, when they were getting their dental work done.
Richard Hall, the investigator that first asked Jeff to write a book about the case years ago, began to believe that Castellanos was the killer. Jeff wasn't so sure.
At first I thought, well, you know, it sounded plausible and sounded like alibiing behavior, and I thought, this could be something. And I was actually, he discovered about the rumors and about rumors about Castellanos' temper and so forth. But he unfolded this portrait of a guy who I thought, okay, well, he may have been the one that killed the co-eds. But it's a long way from sexually harassing women in dental chairs to cutting off the heads of co-eds that you pick up hitchhiking. So that gap was never closed at all. He never got any further than that.
But we all know that dentists really like inflicting pain on people.
They do. And I actually, he did get a lot of calls about dentists in Morgantown.
Like not just Castellanos.
No, just a whole bunch of other dentists. Yeah.
Like everyone wanted to turn their dentist in. I know this fucking sadist.
At the time I was joking with Richard, I said, we got to change this to, like, what the hell's wrong with Dennis in Morgantown? And stop investigating the co-eds and start investigating Dennis.
I have my own Dennis story. They get away with some shit.
You have your own Dennis story?
Yeah.
See, now, females all say this kind of thing.
It wasn't, like, sexual harassment towards me, but they had me under the nitrous, and he was just, like, two steps away from fondling his assistant right in front of me because he thought I'd be high, and I'm like, should I do this all the time? My tolerance is way too high for this. Bring in another tank!
Suspect, John Gerald Schaefer.
Schaefer is pretty prolific. I don't think we have to go into a whole lot about him just because people can look him up. But we can go into why he was a suspect.
John Gerald Schaefer was a deputy with the Marion County Police in Florida. His first arrest happened after he picked up two girls who were trying to hitchhike to the beach. Schaefer took them home, warning them of the dangers of hitchhiking, and told them that he would pick them up and take them to the beach himself the next morning. Instead, he took them into the Florida woods.
He had these ropes hanging from limbs in the trees, which he tied around their necks, and they're balancing themselves on the roots of the tree that are sticking up. And if they don't balance themselves, then they'll hang themselves. So they pretty much have to stay where he puts them. And he's telling these two girls that he's kidnapped them and he's going to sell them into slavery. And he suddenly gets a call on his radio.
Schaefer left the girls there, hoping that the ropes would keep them bound. They did not.
One of the girls frees herself, and she's so terrified of this man that she's afraid that he's sticking around, so she leaves her friend still tied and balancing herself on a root, and she runs to the road and tries to flag someone down to get help. And when it gets back that this girl has a description of a man who works for the county sheriff, who has kidnapped her and her friend, they take her back, they find her friend, and he had a lot to answer for.
Schaefer was arrested, but posted $15,000 bail. Later, authorities would find out that while out on bail,
he had actually decapitated two other girls who were about the age of 19, and they found more bodies as they went on, and he actually turned out to be a pretty prolific serial killer, and the Morgantown police were kind of interested, and the state police decided they were going to interview him and see if there was any connection in the crime, because he liked to pick up girls in pairs. But apparently there wasn't enough evidence found. Not that he was necessarily cleared, but it was unlikely that he was the perpetrator.
As Sarah said, there is a wealth of information about Schaefer available online, so we won't go into too much detail here. Though we're certain that Schaefer was responsible for many murders and dismemberments, he was only convicted in court for the two he killed while out on bond, and was given a life sentence for each. Schaefer was found stabbed to death in his cell in December of 1995. Suspect, Edward Lee Fielder.
He was a very disturbed individual. He was from Bluefield, Woodsville, West Virginia area. He had been arrested at age 18 for a lot of thefts, just breaking in to people's houses and stealing things, not killing anyone at this point.
I have a psychiatric interview and evaluation from November 10th, 1967. One of the things it says is that he is suspicious, aggressive, and has been acting out most of the time. He has poor judgment.
When Fielder got out of jail in 1968, his criminal profile was elevated when he murdered a cab driver.
He had shot the man, robbed him, and then lit him on fire in his cab. He also murdered a hotel manager. That was in West Virginia. He received 50 years for the cabbie, but he received a life sentence with no parole for the hotel manager.
But it was before the trials for these murders had been concluded that Fielder confessed to the murders of Merritt and Karen.
I, Edward Fielder, because of a sound mind, do state that in 1969 I did rob and kill two co-eds in Morgantown, West Virginia. I do not wish to confess to this murder, but due to talking with the prison guard, now I would like to come with a clean slate. And then he goes on with another sentence or two about killing the co-eds and signs it. His handwriting is block handwriting. He obviously doesn't write things down very often.
It didn't take long for the confession to seemingly fall apart.
He had been with a buddy driving in a black car when they picked up the co-eds. They drove less than a mile outside of town. And at that point, he and his buddy raped and murdered Merritt and Karen. Now, by this time, the police are probably going, I don't know about this, because less than a mile out of town is still pretty much in town, even back in 1970. But they continued to take his confession. He said that he and his buddy drove the heads, after they beheaded them, they drove the heads down to a certain place in southern West Virginia where they hid the heads in a shed. He described the place, a shed near a Greyhound station. They went to this shed near a Greyhound station that he described, and they dug it all up, and they were looking around. They didn't find any heads there and couldn't corroborate pretty much anything about his confession. Plus, it didn't match with Skip and Itzy's citing a white car is what they got into, and Fielder had said it was specifically it was a black car. Also, Fielder couldn't come up with the actual name of the friend so that they could track this friend down. So they just couldn't corroborate any of his confessions. And if police can't corroborate anything, they tend to think it didn't happen.
They also didn't make it hidden to him that they didn't believe him. And they actually posted in the Dominion News that they thought there was less than a 1% chance that he was the perpetrator, and it pissed him off. And he said he would no longer help them on the case since they wouldn't take him seriously.
In fact, I have another statement from him to that effect, saying that essentially, I'm not going to talk to anyone who's not a lawyer, so leave me alone.
For some people, this might raise the question, why confess?
It's a fairly well-known phenomenon for prisoners to confess to other crimes in the hopes that they'll get moved to other states. That's something police are well aware of.
This is something that will come up again in the final two episodes of the show. As for the final chapters of Fielder's story...
He escaped prison with another man named Gary Saunders. Gary Saunders was captured pretty quickly. They did an appeal to, I think it was like his girlfriend was like, if you don't come back to prison, we can't get married. And so he came back in willingly, but Fielder did not. Fielder stayed hidden for about 4 months until he was caught breaking and entering again. So then he went back into prison. That's when he stabbed an inmate, and he was secluded from the rest of the other inmates for their safety. And he tied a bed sheet around his neck and hung himself when he was 32.
Suspect, John Kroll. Kroll lived in Cumberland, Maryland, which, of course, is where the triangle letters were postmarked from. It just so happens that I have personal connections to Cumberland and have spent time there intermittently over the years. One of the places I've been more than once is Constitution Park, which is where Kroll's life of violent crime began, just a few months after Merritt and Karen's disappearance.
That summer, as police are still investigating, they're looking around for possible suspects. A young man named John Kroll picked up a 15-year-old girl and frightened her, stabbed her several times, and reportedly almost took her neck off with the knife.
First of all, he hit her with his car so that he could get out and help her up, and he had a penknife on him. And when she tried to get away from him, he stabbed her in the face and the neck so hard that he actually broke the penknife. She was stabbed several times. He tried to slit her ear to ear. And that was one of the reasons they looked at him, because they thought he was attempting to decapitate her. When his knife broke, he then assaulted her sexually and then started beating her with a tree limb because it was the only weapon that he could get his hands on. She was found with severe lacerations to her face and scalp, and he left her there to die. She was actually found by a Boy Scout troop that was in the park at the time, about 4 hours later.
So, of course, the police immediately thought, oh, here's another situation like the co-eds. There's a knife used, and she's being stabbed, and so forth. So they went to check into Mr. Kroll. And Kroll, it turned out, claimed to have been in Morgantown on January 18th at a funeral. And when police tried to substantiate that, they found out that it was true. He was in Morgantown on January 18th.
Authorities would soon learn that this was not the only time Kroll had violently attacked a teenage girl.
It turns out that in 1969, in August, he had also attacked a 13-year-old girl in the same park. So that was the first victim that we know of.
Kroll went to prison, and while he was there, authorities began interviewing his co-workers.
He was an orderly at a hospital in Maryland, and they interviewed his supervisor, and they asked her, you know, what were your feelings on Kroll? Like, what, how was he as a person? Did you have any misgivings about him? And she said, yes, he insisted that he drive me home several times, most times, more than not. And one time when he insisted that he drive me home, he took me past my house and kept saying, I'm going to kidnap you. And I couldn't tell if he was joking or not. And then he took her to some place that he claimed that, you know, he liked to go and he wanted to show her. And then he actually eventually took her back home. And he refused to work on any of the male patients, insisted that he only work with the female patients. And they started complaining so that his supervisor had to be in the room when he was with them, because they said sometimes he would just stand there and stare off into space and it made them feel really uneasy, or the way that he looked at them just felt wrong and they didn't feel safe with him.
West Virginia tried to get him to take a polygraph test. He wouldn't do it. His lawyer wouldn't let him do it, and he refused. And so what they did was they sent someone into the jail cell with him, who lived with him for a couple days and talked with him about various things, posing as another criminal. And after that, he came out and just said to his superiors with state police, said, Kroll didn't do this. He's talking crazy. He just talked about Superman landing on his house, the roof of his house. This guy doesn't make any sense at all. So I don't think he did the co-eds. And as it later turned out, when he had been in Morgantown on the 18th for a funeral, he'd been there with his parents, who he drove back to Cumberland with.
Kroll was in jail for a surprisingly short period of time. Sexual assaults didn't carry the same social weight as they do now, and despite the additional brutal violence, he was out in less than 10 years. That's when he headed across the Pennsylvania state line, where he found his next victim.
He attacked a 9-year-old girl who was waiting at the bus stop. He grabbed her and threw her in his trunk, and then he mutilated her genitals with a sharpened broomstick.
Kroll dropped the girl off at home, instructing her to tell her parents she was injured on a swing set at school. He was arrested later that day and convicted again. Kroll probably didn't kill Meriden Karen. He was set to be released from prison 30 years later, in 2010, a year that Maryland was deciding whether to allow harsher sentencing for sex offenders. Testifying in the General Assembly for passage of that strict legislation, the woman he had sexually tortured as a child. She was 39 years old at the time. The new legislation passed, and as a result, Kroll will never be free again. Suspect Eddie Slaughter.
On April 5th, West Virginia state police officers were walking around canvassing the region where Merritt's purse was found, just looking around that farm. It was 10 days before the bodies were found. At a farm in the Halleck Road, at a home owned by Roy and Beulah Bird, they met a young man named Eddie Slaughter, who was 20 years old, visiting his grandparents, he said. As it turned out later, he wasn't visiting his grandparents, he lived there with Roy and Beulah Bird.
Even more interesting, Slaughter had been working at Westchester, Merritt and Karen's dorm, until early January, just weeks before they disappeared. The police had stumbled onto Slaughter by chance, in the area where Merritt's purse was discovered, on April 5th.
Now, the day before, on April 4th, a report had been made by a woman named Maxine Blankenship about having been approached in December by a peculiar man who said he worked as a custodian at WVU. She was waiting for a ride from some people that she worked with, and they hadn't been there, and she was standing at a service station. A car pulled in and asked her if she wanted a ride. And she said, no, I've got some people coming to get me. But he talked her into, because it was cold, he talked her into getting into the car with him to just sit and wait. And she agreed to do that. She said, okay, if you get out and go on the passenger side, I'll sit on the driver's side and turn on the heater and we'll sit there. And so he agreed to that. Now, she was wearing a fur coat and a hat. And the boy told her how great she looked and what a nice coat that was and what a nice hat that was.
In a previous episode, we learned that when Merritt and Karen's bodies were found, the only things they were missing were a fur coat and a pair of fur boots.
His talk began to get stranger and stranger, and then at one point he said that he liked to rub furry things. So she got kind of weirded out at that point and just said, okay, I'm getting out now, and got out of the car and walked away from him. Police, like I say, she reported this to the police on April 4th because of the situation with murders of the co-eds. She thought maybe this kid had something to do with it.
It's worth noting here that the girls' bodies had not yet been discovered at this point, so Maxine wouldn't have been reporting this to the police because of the comments about fur. And police didn't reveal that fact anyway. Slaughter just freaked her out so much that she figured, better safe than sorry.
And turned out now he worked at Sterling Fawcett, a manufacturing plant nearby. So they went to Sterling Fawcett and inquired about his work record and his work habits. And they managed to, they discovered that on January 18th and January 19th, he wasn't at work and he was supposed to be, but he had called in sick.
Very interested now. Police went to Slaughter's grandparents' house and retrieved some of Slaughter's old school notebooks.
So they can compare handwriting, because police were fixated now on the letter writers as the possible perpetrators of the crime. So they were getting as many handwriting samples as they could. They also went back to Maxine Blankenship and showed her a photo lineup of a lot of people, about 10, 20 people in that lineup. They used a picture of Slaughter they'd gotten from his grandparents, and it was 2 years old. And when she looked at the pictures, various pictures that she was shown, she said, well, it could be these two guys, and this one guy looks the most like him, but it's not quite like him, but I'm not even sure it's him, but looks the most like him, I think. And that picture was the old picture of Slaughter that the grandparents had supplied.
Despite Maxine's tentative identification of Slaughter, handwriting analysis showed that he almost certainly wasn't the author of the triangle letters. And as the number of suspects with real histories of violence kept rising, he ended up just part of the paperwork pile. He was never cleared, per se. He just sort of faded out of the picture. A quick teaser, though. If it seems like our listeners are still with us after we've concluded episode 6, we have even more stories surrounding this case, not only about this guy, but others we're discussing today. Suspect, Alan R. Estep III.
The last week of April, a man came to the Morgantown detachment and told them about an engineering student that he knew named Alan R. Estep, who had prepared an outline of a religious cult dealing with decapitations. Wilt had also heard a rumor that a roommate of Estep had at the time a machete, which had since disappeared and possibly stolen by Estep.
Estep had been a successful aerospace engineering student. But in 1968, 1 year before America put the first person on the moon, he started to have problems.
He was hospitalized the day before the co-eds were found. He was hospitalized for illness, which the police couldn't find out what that was until after they got a warrant from Judge Kiger and obtained his medical records. Again, as it turned out, he had been hospitalized 4 or 5 times in the previous few years, starting in September 1968. When they talked to the doctor, armed with this warrant, He admitted that Estep was suffering from an acute mental illness.
Today, patient privacy is protected, even from police in most cases, by federal HIPAA legislation. But in 1970, police were able to eventually talk to several doctors about Estep's mental condition, and they had several unsettling things to say about him.
That he was having marital discord, that he had tried to set fire to his trailer while his wife was in it. He failed at that, and he ended up stabbing the ground with a knife over and over again in the middle of the trailer court. That he had written a story in the fall of 1969 about involving decapitation, maybe decapitation of two females. They heard various takes on what that story was and various people who claimed to have seen the story, but they never were able to get a copy of the story.
Doctors weren't the only ones with strange stories, some of which police didn't even have to seek out.
On April 30th, a minister at the First Presbyterian Church came forward and said that, filed a statement. He had seen a man who came to his church on January 29th, 1970. He'd wandered around in the church and ended up in the chapel just sitting there and staring. Finally, the minister went in and asked if there was something he could help with. And at first, he just stared. He didn't say anything. He didn't do anything. And made the minister very nervous. This is a quote from his report. He said, "Is he going to pull a knife, jump on me, or break into tears?" He didn't know. The guy was obviously very brittle, on edge. I tried to calm him, and again I asked if I could be of any help. He mumbled something that I could not understand. He then stated, "Guess you know why I'm here. I have already taken steps to correct the situation." The more the minister thought about that, the more he thought he should notify the police. And so he did. And again, it was Estep was one of the two pictures he pulled out of a photo lineup, this time of 35 different pictures.
In addition to all this, Estep was a bouncer at the Castle Club, where Merritt and Karen were known to frequent. Also the club where the band that was investigated early on, Ezra, was playing the night of their disappearance.
Was Karen the one that had the Castle Club ID?
Yes, it was in her name.
Was that a membership?
No, it's if you wanted to drink at any establishment in public, you had to buy a membership card, which most places sold for a buck.
So that wasn't just that bar, but
no, that was state law.
Wow, didn't know that.
Yeah. So they took his handwriting, they profiled him and so forth. He'd been in a couple of car accidents, but he had no record to speak of, other than these incidents they kept hearing about his temper. He seemed to have an alibi for January 18th, and they asked him to come in for a polygraph. But when he got there, the trooper said that Estep was so nervous that the trooper decided, okay, well, just calm down and come back next weekend and do it. And Estep promised to do that, but never did. And that's the end of the trail. Until 35 years later, when Richard Hall looked into Estep more deeply.
Suspect, William Bernard Hacker.
So basically in 1970 in December.
On Christmas Eve.
It was Christmas Eve. Hacker was apprehended by the police because they had found a headless nude man in Upper Tract in West Virginia. He had been shot in the head and then Hacker had cut his head off. He'd left his body nude alongside the road on a private farm. They had found out that he had gone out to see one of his girlfriends. He was married at the time, but one of his girlfriends, who was actually seeing Herbert Coben, who was from Star City, which is close to Morgantown, and he didn't like his girlfriend cheating on him with this man, so he offered to go to a few more bars and hang out with Herbert while she was at home, and then Herbert just never really came back. And he actually ended up knocking on her door at 2 o'clock in the morning and demanding that she come out. And she refused. And that probably saved her life.
Coben's body was found in a makeshift grave of sticks and stones and leaves. And that's one of the reasons that the police started looking at, oh, there's some similarities here to Meriden Cairn, less than a year later.
Like, that wasn't his first crime, by far. But in 1953, he had been in a bar called Wright's Tavern, which was nicknamed Bucket of Blood. And he had gone there to find his girlfriend and have her come home and cook for him, basically. And she was seen talking to another man, and he flew into a rage and slapped her. And the other man basically was like, get out of here. So he left, and 30 minutes later, he came back with a gun, and he shot them both. And he was arrested for that.
Hacker had an interesting history. He was born in 1896 in Brooklyn, New York, and he and his family came down to this area, settled in Monongah, which is near Fairmont, about 20 minutes from Morgantown.
It's actually not that far from where the girls were found.
His father was probably a coal miner, but that's never really been known. But in Monongah, an interesting thing happened. A terrible tragedy, crime, some people would say. The Monongah mine blew up, and it killed... Estimates at the time were 250 people. It turns out it was twice that, almost 500 people. And also at the time, a lot of children worked in the mines, including Hacker. And probably he was one of the people that helped clean up after the Monongah mine disaster in 1907.
And it is documented that a lot of those miners were decapitated.
Yes. Many of the casualties, because the explosion was so sudden, a lot of the deaths were caused by decapitation.
A lot of dismemberment and decapitation.
If he helped clean up afterwards, he would have seen a lot of that. Then after that, he worked in mines all over the area. He did work for some time at the Weirton Mine.
Quick reminder, that's the mine right by the place where Merritt and Karen's bodies were found.
So he knew the area. He had been up here. And there had been a mysterious decapitation there, in fact, in the late 1920s, that potentially could be linked to Hacker. I mean, that, there was never any demonstration of that, but that's a decapitation in the Weirton Mine section. And so police got more interested, of course, in the history of this guy. In addition to the murders in the 50s, his wife disappeared in 1937. Later, the rumor was that later her shoe was found in the...
Concrete
at the porch on the front of the house, a porch that Hacker built with his own hands. I mean, it's tempting to say, oh, this could have been Hacker, and it could have been, but at some point you have to say, well, there's no evidence of that. And I spent an afternoon talking with a trooper who was investigating the cold case of Hacker, because there was some question about whether he was involved in the co-ed murders, and this person said that Hacker, he just liked killing.
Now, there were some rumors on Facebook that people were sharing about Hacker chasing a man 2 miles through the woods trying to kill him.
Trying to kill him, yes.
Everybody had a Hacker story.
When Hacker was taken to prison in 1970 for the murder beheading, he claimed that he didn't have anything to do with it. He also claimed that he didn't have anything to do with Merritt and Karen.
After he'd been in there for a little while, in the spring of 71, he said, well, no, actually, maybe I do have something to say about the co-eds thing, but I won't talk to the police. I'll only talk to a reporter with a Morgantown paper. The prison authorities said, no, we won't let a reporter in to talk to you. And he said, okay, then I won't talk at all. And he never did.
Were just a few of many people suspected in the murders of Merritt and Karen. In light of these disturbing tales, I want to bring things full circle to the topic that started the episode. As I've mentioned previously, Jeff, and now Sarah, are working on a book compiling the fine details of this case. So Jeff, when you started this book, you have a title that you've abandoned it now. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it was a title I used back when I was shadowing Richard Hall in his investigation, because we had there was one suspect after another, and I got to think that there were so many of them that I used the tentative title Parade of Horribles.
I mean, just the sheer number of people we've talked about who were decapitators in the region in the general time frame seems like statistically unlikely to me. And we're talking about a relatively remote area, and the population isn't that big. It's not that big now, and yet we have these like crazy stories about severely disturbed and violent people. I was wondering what you guys thought about that.
Yeah, well, violent crime is way down from the 70s. That's true. And a lot of people nowadays tend to perceive this as being a very violent time, but it's actually less violent than ever in the history of the United States. The other thing is that I think is a factor is crimes that would happen from jurisdiction to jurisdiction never got put together. So what to us looks like a pattern of decapitations, in those days it was just, oh yeah, I think I heard about a decapitation up the road about 20 miles. So jurisdictional things, if you cross the state boundary, even if you cross the county boundary, they never got seen as being too, oh, that's the same thing.
It wasn't really federal at that time. It was this state calls it CIB. This state calls it, ICB. I mean, they weren't even the same within states. So we've got each state kind of handling their own thing in the 70s and just starting out as pictures, fingerprints, any kind of police report that we've ever gotten our hands on. That was the beginning.
Those are the beginnings of trying to transcend the boundaries problem.
Even if you look through the newspapers, they will describe murder scenes, I mean, just to the goriest detail, because people were expected that death was just all around all the time. And I think we've become a little bit more sensitive about that because we're not around it as much. But back then, we've got kids who are working in the mines at age 10, or in Schaefer's case, there was a lot of childhood trauma. His parents had wanted a girl and he was a boy and he was treated differently. He was dressed in women's clothes, and whenever he would play with his sister, sometimes she would tie him to a tree, and he became very sexually attached to that. And that's why he was tying these women to trees and raping them. I think it was a lot easier for people to get away with abusing their children than it is now. And there's also a theory that we put lead in everything and it affected people's frontal lobes and it made them more violent. I mean, we'll never really know why people were as violent as they were then, but I think it was definitely different.
That's all for episode 4 of Appalachian Mysteria, the WVU Co-Ed Murders. Coming up in episode 5, we arrive at the point that all of this has been building to, the trials of the man convicted for the crime, but did he really do it? You can find Chromatic Media and the WVU Co-Ed Murders on Facebook and at coedmurders.com. If you enjoyed the show, take 2 seconds to rate it on your favorite podcasting service to help other listeners find good stuff. Season 1 of Appalachian Mysteria is produced by myself and Sarah Gibbons, with lots of assistance by Jeff Fuller. Our theme song, which you can hear right now, along with other instrumental tracks, were written and recorded by Nick Larson, John Smithers, Annie Stroud, and Nathan Snyder. Our soundtrack is comprised entirely of songs by Morgantown musicians. First up, we had Arrows, from the same Nathan Snyder that produced our instrumental tracks. Next up, False Pterodactyl with Roses. and Humans Etc. with Before Skating. Special thanks to Lori Hostutler at the WVU Library for her assistance in research. And last episode, I forgot to thank one of our guests, Nancy Burkhammer, for speaking with us about her experience hitchhiking and her memories about living in Meriden Caron's dorm. Thanks, Nancy. Stay tuned.